Today is Monday, February 8th, and you're listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I am Chinedu Ofor, broadcasting from Washington, D.C. Coming up, protests continues against military coup in Myanmar.
Large protests took place in cities like Yangon, Naypyidaw, and Mandalay in the wake of last week's coup.
Also ahead, Washington set for COVID relief bill and trial of former President Trump.
Congressional committees will begin the work of crafting legislation on components of President Joe Biden's stimulus plan.
Plus, a new case of Ebola virus detected in the DRC. These stories and more are next. Police have fired water cannons at hundreds of protesters in Myanmar's capital who are demanding the military hand power back to elected officials. Demonstrations against last week's coup are intensifying Monday and spreading to more parts of the country. The protest also swelled at major downtown intersection in the country's largest city, Yangon, with people raising a three-finger salute that is a symbol of resistance and carrying placards saying, quote, reject the military coup, unquote. VOA's Arash Arabasadi reports that tens of thousands of people took to the streets over the weekend in protest and called for the release of the country's democratically elected leader, Aung San Suu Kyi.
Large protests took place in cities like Yangon, Naypyidaw, and Mandalay in the wake of last week's military coup. Aung San Main is a protest leader.
A military coup is the violation of our democracy and human rights. It also insults the will of the people. That's why we are against the military coup. It's important to honor the election result. That's why we come here staging protests.
The protests follow a week in which the military claimed election fraud, arrested members of the government elected in November, and cut off access to the internet. Internet service was reported to have been restored Sunday. Protesters showing the three-fingered salute, a symbol against the coup, demanded the release of de facto leader Aung San Suu Kyi. They wore red in solidarity with Aung San Suu Kyi's National League for Democracy Party, or NLD. The military coup has been condemned by U.S. President Joe Biden and other world leaders who have called for the elected government to be restored to power. Arash Arabasadi, VOA News.
Pope Francis on Sunday said that he followed the situation in Myanmar with, quote, great concern, unquote, appealing to those who have responsibility in the country to work for the common good and democratic coexistence. The pontiff made the remarks as tens of thousands took to the streets in an effort to roll back last Monday's seizure of power by the military in the Southeast Asian country. The UN chief is pledging that the United Nations will do everything it can to unite the international community and create conditions for the military coup in Myanmar to be reversed. Secretary General Antonio Guterres said it is absolutely essential to carry out the UN Security Council's call for a return to democracy, respect for the results of the November elections, and release of all people detained by the military, which he says means the reversal of the coup. Australia says it has serious concerns about an economic advisor to the Myanmar's former de facto leader, Aung San Suu Kyi, who has been detained by police. From Sydney, VOA's Phil Mercer reports.
Sean Turnell, an Australian academic, has been a key economic aide to Myanmar's de facto leader, Aung San Suu Kyi. Her National League for Democracy party won a landslide victory in an election last November with more than 80% of the vote. Suu Kyi and Turnell have been detained, along with others, by the military, which seized power in Myanmar Monday. Turnell is an associate economics professor at Sydney's Macquarie University. Its website says he's away for an extended period after taking up the post of senior economic advisor to the government of Myanmar. In a message to the Reuters news service, he said he was fine and strong and not guilty of anything, along with a smile emoji. Earlier he wrote on Twitter that the military takeover was gut-wrenching and heartbreaking and an utter catastrophe for the economy. Australian Foreign Affairs Minister Maurice Payne said in a statement her government was deeply concerned about reports of Australian and other foreign nationals being detained arbitrarily in Myanmar. Myanmar's ambassador to Canberra has been called in by the federal government. Tim Harcourt from the University of New South Wales Business School is a friend of Turnell's.
I was talking to Sean the day before, or a couple of days before, when the coup had happened, and I was basically saying to him, listen, mate, you better get out of there, you know, be safe, you know. And he seemed more concerned for his Burmese friends and colleagues, you know, Aung San Suu Kyi and all his colleagues. He said, no, he's fine, he's been treated well, he's all fine. And then the next day I heard he was detained. DFAT had arranged for Sean to fly out, and they were about to accompany him to the airport, and basically the military got there first.
Myanmar was controlled by a repressive military government from 1962 to 2011. A government effectively led by Suu Kyi came to power after elections in 2015. The overthrow of her administration prompted thousands of people to gather Saturday in Yangon, the nation's biggest city, to condemn the military takeover and demand the release of their elected leaders. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Haitian President Jovenel Moïse says police have arrested more than 20 people he accused of trying to kill him and overthrow his government, including a Supreme Court judge who has the support of opposition leaders demanding that Moïse step down. Moïse spoke Sunday, flanked by the country's prime minister and the police chief. He said the alleged plot began on November 20, but did not provide further details or evidence. Prime Minister Joseph Yute later said that authorities found several weapons and a speech that Supreme Court Judge Vicaire de Brazil had allegedly prepared if he were to become provisional president. De Brazil is one of three judges the opposition favor as a potential transitional president. Also, Justice Minister Rockefeller Vincent accused the Inspector General of being in touch with high-ranking security officials at the National Palace over an alleged plot to have the president arrested. This week, Washington will tackle two important issues: the $1.9 trillion economic relief package President Joe Biden has proposed and the Senate impeachment trial of his immediate predecessor, Donald Trump. VOA's Michelle Quinn reports.
The U.S. Capitol, the scene of much drama in recent weeks, will again be the center of attention as lawmakers debate the economic stimulus amid the coronavirus pandemic and hold arguments during the impeachment trial of former President Donald Trump. Congressional committees will begin the work of crafting legislation on components of President Joe Biden's stimulus plan, which would provide aid to families, workers, businesses, and local governments. Many Republicans argue that the plan is too big and not narrowly targeted to address only the issues that have arisen because of the pandemic. Democrats say that the package needs to be passed fast, given the nation's economic crisis. Pete Buttigieg is the U.S. Transportation Secretary.
The bottom line is we've got to support as many Americans as we can, as robustly as we can, and as quickly as we can. Time is of the essence.
Trump's impeachment trial will take place in the Senate in the afternoons on one article of impeachment that his words and actions led to the incitement of an insurrection at the Capitol on January 6th, an allegation that Trump has denied. Senator Roger Wicker, a Republican from Mississippi, called the trial a meaningless messaging partisan exercise.
The charge, George, in the impeachment, in the one article impeachment, is that he singularly incited a riot to invade the Capitol, and I do not think that will be proved in the trial, no.
With the Senate divided evenly between 50 Republicans and 50 Democrats, 17 Republicans would have to join Democrats to convict the president, a high bar to clear. Michelle Quinn, VOA News.
Democrats and Republicans are laying out their strategies ahead of Tuesday's start to the second impeachment trial of Donald Trump. VOA's Steve Reddish explains what is behind the arguments for both sides.
Last month's attack on the U.S. Capitol prompted the House of Representatives, led by Democrats with the support of 10 Republicans, to impeach then-President Donald Trump for an unprecedented second time. House Democrats, who will prosecute the case before the jury of U.S. senators, say Trump incited the attack that killed five people, including a Capitol police officer.
and they will use Trump's own words and video from the riot to try to sway the jury.
In terms of the strategy that the Democratic Party is using, which is to say, you know, this guy is a threat. He is still a threat. He is currently a threat. He was a threat. The insurrection is a result of his violent incitement rhetoric.
Jennifer Murcia is a professor of American political rhetoric at Texas A&M University.
So if they can activate people's memories of the event and they can, sort of remind them of the fear that they felt and reactivate that fight or flight response, they might find that they're able to persuade, you know, even beyond the partisanship.
With the 100-member Senate evenly split, Democrats need 17 Republicans to join them to vote to convict former President Trump. But the word former is at the crux of the Republican strategy. Republican Senator Rand Paul.
If the accused is no longer president, where is the constitutional power to impeach him? Private citizens don't get impeached. Impeachment is for removal from office. And the accused here has already left office.
Republicans lost a vote on the trial's constitutionality, but the 55-45 vote leaves Democrats well shy of the 67 votes needed. Again, Jennifer Murcia.
I think they really are just trying to keep this at the level of procedure. This is simply a procedural question at this point. We're not going to relitigate, you know, this question of violence and the insurrection and whether Trump's at fault or not.
And Murcia says social media's silencing of Trump may work against the Democrats' strategy.
They really will be trying to use fear appeal, you know, and make the argument about safety and that he's a clear and present danger. And I think the fact that he's been deplatformed really actually hurts that argument, because if he was still online, he would still be making all of those same arguments. He would still be that clear and present danger.
House Democrats formally requested that Trump testify at his impeachment trial set to start Tuesday. When asked if he will testify, lawyers for the former president said no. Steve Reddish, VOA News, Washington.
Meanwhile, a fight over the future of the Republican Party is underway as former President Trump goes on trial in the Senate. VOA's Ken Farabaugh reports from the Midwestern state of Illinois, where a Republican congressman is weathering intense blowback for demanding his party turn the pages on Trump in the aftermath of the January 6th assault on the U.S. Capitol.
Illinois Republicans like Shirley Prescott are turning on one of their own.
We are mad. We are furious. We will never vote for him again.
The focus of their anger is Congressman Adam Kinzinger.
The Republican Party has lost its way.
Kinzinger voted to impeach former President Donald Trump after a mob of his supporters assaulted the U.S. Capitol January 6th. And wants the Republican Party to expunge Trump's brand of politics.
By poisonous conspiracies and lies. This is not the Republican road.
The county Republican Party in Kinzinger's district recently voted to censure him. Larry Smith is chairman of the LaSalle County Republican Party.
Our congressman has, in our opinion, gone off the rails and said things that we don't agree with. What he's been saying about our former president and his supporters and a lot of conservative Republicans is not okay.
But local Republican opinion is not unified. Susan Thornton is a former chairperson of the LaSalle County Republican Party.
Proud to be a Republican. I can't see anyone saying that right now. After what has happened, I can't see it. Who could be proud of these people running around in red hats and being mean to other people for no reason other than they don't love Trump?
Thornton and Smith's opposing views illustrate a growing fault line in a party where tens of millions of voters remain intensely loyal to a former president many others view as toxic. Now an independent, Thornton nevertheless backs Kinzinger and nine other Republican lawmakers in the House who voted to make Trump the first U.S. president twice impeached.
It did take courage. It did.
It could also put political careers in jeopardy. Larry Smith wants Republicans to replace Kinzinger in the next election cycle.
Kinzinger has earned himself a primary.
Northwestern University's Laurel Harbridge Young says banishing anti-Trump Republicans could make the party less palatable to the general voting public.
It points to how members are more focused on
a small number of people in their constituency, their primary electorate, and even within that, this kind of ardent base, whose interests may not be the same as the rest of their constituents.
Susan Thornton welcomes Kinzinger's battle to reform the party, but says more is needed before she would consider herself a Republican again.
They would have to disavow Trump as a leader, as their messenger, because his message is not acceptable to me. We'd have to get back to decency and respect.
Trump loyalists say they are planning more events across the United States targeting lawmakers like Kinzinger, pledging to reshape the party in Trump's image, one primary election at a time. Kane Faerbaugh, VOA News, Ottawa, Illinois.
This is the Voice of America. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has pleaded not guilty as his trial on corruption charges resumes in a Jerusalem courtroom. Monday's hearing comes just weeks before national elections, in which Netanyahu hopes to extend his 12-year rule. A Chinese-born Australian journalist has been formally arrested in China on suspicion of illegally supplying state secrets overseas. Cheng Lei worked for CGTN, the English-language channel of China Central Television. South Korea says it will give pet dogs and cats free coronavirus tests if they come into contact with infected humans and show symptoms. You are listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I am Chinedu Ofo, broadcasting from Washington, D.C. Four skiers were killed when one of the deadliest avalanches in the history of the U.S. state of Utah hit a popular backcountry skiing area. Police said four other people were also buried in the Saturday slide, but managed to dig themselves out and didn't suffer serious injuries. The skiers were from two separate groups, both of which had prepared with the necessary avalanche safety gear. The four killed were all from the Salt Lake City area, not far from the spot where they were swept up by the avalanche in Mid Creek Canyon. Avalanche forecasters rated the danger high this weekend. Rescuers in northern India are working to rescue more than three dozen power plant workers trapped in a tunnel after part of a Himalayan glacier broke off and sent a wall of water and debris rushing down the mountain. Lauren Anthony of Reuters reports that about 140 people are missing, with floods forcing the evacuation of villages downstream.
Several bodies have already been recovered. One witness said a wall of dust, rock and water hit as an avalanche roared down the Rishi Ganga Valley, deep in the mountains of Uttarakhand. Many of those missing are workers at the Rishi Ganga hydroelectric project, which was destroyed. 12 people who had been trapped in a tunnel had been rescued, and efforts were underway to save others caught in another, according to the Federal Home Ministry. Local Puran Singh Rana saw the disaster.
I was looking up and down and I could not see anything. But 5 minutes later, I witnessed something that looked like a scene from a Bollywood film. I've never seen anything like what I saw at the Rishi Ganga plant. About 50 to 100 people were running for their lives but could not be saved, and they were engulfed by the river.
It was not immediately clear what had set off the avalanche outside of flood season, but Uttarakhand is prone to flash floods and landslides, and environmental groups have now called for a review of power projects in the ecologically sensitive mountains.
That's Lauren Anthony of Reuters. A new study by international humanitarian organization Doctors Without Borders and the University of Geneva shows that insulin can be stored at warmer temperatures, making it easier for people with diabetes who live in places without reliable access to refrigeration to receive treatment. The study concluded that strict cold storage recommendations for insulin are difficult to follow in tropical regions and even more challenging in conflict and humanitarian emergency settings, adding an extra burden for people managing diabetes. For more, I spoke with Dr. Philippa Bull, MSF Non-Communicable Diseases Advisor.
People don't have access to refrigeration in very many parts of the world, meant that either clinicians were reluctant to give them insulin to take home, and so often insulin was being stored in health services, in hospitals, and patients were forced to come to the hospital twice a day or more to receive their insulin. In our settings, we saw that patients were having to travel very long distances, sometimes even having to therefore stay all day at the hospital, every day of their lives, in order to receive their insulin injections. And other patients, we had a couple of examples where sort of part of the family, the child and one parent, were even relocating to live near the hospital.
What does this new report mean for those patients who have had a difficult time accessing or even keeping the efficacy of insulin?
It gives us a lot more confidence to be able to give patients insulin to take home where the temperatures are higher than kind of normal 25 degrees. Of course, we always then recommend that they store it in locally made cooling containers. It needs to be stored, of course, out of direct heat. But it really just removes this barrier because we know that it should be safe and perfectly efficacious. What we saw was we were looking at fluctuating temperatures up to 37 degrees, but just in general, a lot more confidence that, you know, clinicians shouldn't see lack of refrigeration and hot temperatures as a barrier to prescribing insulin for their patients. And really, people living with diabetes absolutely should have a fundamental right to be injecting their own insulin and able to try and live as normal a life as possible. And this makes that more feasible.
Now, what do you make of comments by critics that unless better explained to the public, a lot of people might think you just take your insulin home and you don't even have to refrigerate it, and that might defeat the purpose of this study?
This is something where what we want is to be a strong and clear consensus statement from different organizations, you know, reputable organizations involved in diabetes care and really hopefully led or endorsed by the WHO so that we can really make these instructions clear. It's just a case of trying to explain it properly. I understand the concern around that. I think it's very valid and I think we need to address it. But I absolutely don't think that we can go backwards because of that fear. We absolutely need to go forwards and make insulin more available to people who need it. Globally around the world, 50% of those who require insulin don't have it. We need to start removing all the barriers to that. This is one barrier, and we need to see how to move forward, removing this barrier so we can address some of the other ones.
That's Dr. Philippa Bohr, MSF Non-Communicable Diseases Advisor, speaking with me from Geneva. A new case of the Ebola virus has been detected in the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo near the city of Butembo, and the infected person has died, the health ministry said on Sunday. Edward Baran of Reuters reports.
A new case of the Ebola virus has been detected in Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo near the city of Butembo, and the infected person has died, the health ministry said on Sunday. A woman was found with symptoms of the deadly virus in the town of Biena on February 1st. She died in hospital in Butembo 2 days later. She was married to a man who had contracted the virus in a previous outbreak. The announcement potentially marks the start of Congo's 12th Ebola outbreak since the virus was discovered near the Ebola River in 1976. It comes nearly 3 months after Congo announced the end to its 11th outbreak, hundreds of miles away in the west, which infected 130 people and killed 55. That outbreak overlapped with an earlier one in the east that killed more than 2,200 people, the second most in the disease's history. The emergence of more cases could complicate efforts to eradicate COVID-19, which has infected over 23,000 people and killed almost 700 in Democratic Republic of Congo. Congo's equatorial forests are a natural reservoir for the Ebola virus, which causes severe vomiting and diarrhea and is spread through contact with bodily fluids.
That's Reuters correspondent Edward Baran. Pope Francis will meet with Iraq's top Shiite Muslim cleric Ali al-Sattani during a trip next month that will also include a pilgrimage to ancient Christian communities that were emptied and devastated in battles with Islamic State groups. That's it for our show today. For more in-depth and breaking news 24 hours a day, please visit voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Nadia Taha, and our managing editor, Kate Pound-Dawson, I am Chinedu Ofo in Washington. Thank you so much for listening and have a great day.